This is a very obscure text. Today we're going to take a break from the book of Acts, which we've been traveling through in this congregation for the past few months, to take a look at a very archaic and mysterious passage from Exodus. And as Helicon already mentioned, the working title of this is, What the Heaven? Divine Confrontation for Believers. Originally, it was going to be Divine Confrontation of Believers, when God decides to bring some discipline on his people. But I changed it to confrontation for believers because I think there's something that believers are supposed to get out of these moments. I believe that God is unwilling to allow any believer to follow him half-heartedly. If an individual is really seeking God, they will eventually be the recipient of divine discipline. Now, these moments seem to coincide with pivotal moments in our faith journey and confront us in such powerful and such deeply personal ways that we are forced to make a choice to either embrace or deny God. Now, our text this morning provides us with a stunning example of this kind of confrontation and opens dialogue for where and how God might engage us in his divine discipline. So why on earth this text? Well, to be honest, I had a hard time tracking down where we were leaving off in Acts. And so by the time I got the text, it was kind of too late. I already had to commit. And I have always been baffled by this passage. Another reason is that for me personally, I've found myself in kind of a metaphorical wilderness period in life. And the story of Moses and his life, he's got a long stint where he just hangs out in the wilderness shepherding the flocks of his father-in-law. And so I thought, oh yeah, Moses, I'll go back and take a look at that story. And sure enough, Moses was there, and then there was this episode. And I thought, all right, I gotta do some research and find out what on earth is going on. But to bring you up to speed on the Moses story, I'm guessing many of you are familiar with it, but just in case you're not, let me go back a little bit. So set the Wayback Machine for a couple millennia ago. The Israelite people were in Egypt. They were slaves, indentured servants in the land of Egypt. And as the people of Egypt of Israel continued to multiply, the Pharaoh was very concerned that the Israelites were going to outnumber the Egyptians, and this would be a very scary thing because now the ethnic minority is becoming the ethnic majority, but they're still not the ones in power yet. So he makes a law that says any Hebrew male child that is born has to be thrown into the Nile River and keep those crocodiles healthy and fed, right? No. So Moses' parents, when he's born, they already have two kids. They've got Miriam, who's the oldest, and then Aaron. I guess he was born before this edict. Then they have their third kid, Moses. And the rule is in place, the mother hides the baby as long as she can and nurses him as long as she can. But when he's old enough that there's just no way that they can keep this child hidden, they decide to follow the letter of the law, if not the spirit, and they create a little raft out of twigs and branches, put the baby in it, and send it floating down the stream. The oldest sister follows the baby along the bank. She wants to see what's going to happen. And the baby floats past where the Pharaoh's daughter, the princess, is taking a bath with her handmaids. She sees the baby. They fish it out. And they say, oh, it's a cute little Hebrew baby. I'm going to adopt him. And the princess gives Moses his name, Moses, which means one who is drawn out. I don't know how much you've thought about the meaning of your name or who gave it to you, but it's worth pausing to consider. So Moses is drawn out of the water. From there on, he lives a very, very interesting, if not very culturally confusing, life. He is raised in Pharaoh's court as the son of the princess. But when it comes to the question of, well, who's going to take care of this baby? Because he was still breastfeeding, his older sister had followed and said to the princess, oh, I know a lady who could nurse that baby. His mom. So Moses grows up on some level being conscious of his birth family and culture and of his adopted family and culture. Have you ever thought about Moses as a cross-cultural person before? So he grows up having many of the rights and privileges accorded to the ruling class, but he also knows that deep in his heart he belongs to this other people group, and neither people group seem to want to own him entirely. I say that because when Moses is a young adult, he is trying to sort out this stuff. To whom do I belong? Which group am I a part of? And he's got, from a very early age, a real deep desire to do the right thing. And he knows that he is in a position of power and authority. And if you've ever seen the Spider-Man movies or comic books, with great power comes great responsibility. And the Bible says that at one point he's out there and he sees an Egyptian beating up a Hebrew slave. And the Bible says he looks one way, then another, and then springs into action. If you read it one way, it's like Moses is looking like, all right, I've got to make sure nobody's going to catch me. But one of my Old Testament professors in seminary pointed out that the way that the Hebrew language is worded in that sentence, it's not that Moses is trying not to get caught. It's that he's looking around for somebody to intervene. He's seeing violence breaking out, and he's going, who's going to stop this? Is somebody call 911? Is anybody? Nobody? Oh, shoot. Okay, here we go. Moses intervenes, and in the course of intervening, winds up killing the Egyptian. Because of that, he suddenly becomes a wanted man and has to flee the land of Egypt. He goes all the way down the Sinai Peninsula, down to the land of Midian. And there he sits down at a well, and some cute shepherd girls come by with their flocks. And he's a big, strong, strapping guy. And just as the girls get to the well, a bunch of, you know, rough and tumble shepherds come and chase the girls away. Moses fights the shepherds off and waters the girls' flocks. And they say, oh, my hero. And they run back and tell their dad, Daddy, Daddy, there's this nice Egyptian man who helped us out. And he said, well, why'd you leave him at the well? Bring him home. Interestingly enough, Moses never bothers to correct them as to whether or not he's Egyptian, Hebrew. He's like, you know what? Whatever. I'm so tired of trying to figure out who I am. Just sure. Well, he finds a home there. The guy who adopts him in happens to be a pagan priest and named Jethro, and he marries Moses off to his oldest daughter, Zipporah. And while Moses is there, he's there for a long time. The Bible doesn't give us the length of period that he's in Midian, but he's there for quite a while. And he has a kid. His firstborn son gets named Gershom. Aren't you glad you're not Gershom? But you see in this child's name a moment of Moses reflecting a little bit on his own identity. Gershom sounds a lot in Hebrew like the phrase, I am a stranger in a strange land. He names his kid Alien. And so things go on for a while longer. Moses continues to live a life of exile. On the one hand, he's free to just kind of be, doesn't have the pressures and politics of Pharaoh's court. But on the other hand, he's exiled from the family of origin that he knows and loves. It is about at this time then, after many years, that Moses has his encounter with the burning bush, and God calls him to return back to Egypt, back from where he has come from, back to where he is technically a wanted man, to go and deliver God's message both to the Israelites and to Pharaoh, that it's time for the Israelites to be set free. Moses, if you have read this passage, is not at all keen on this idea and tries everything he can to get out of it. He says, well, Lord, who am I? I'm just a nobody. God says, no, you're the person I want. Well, Lord, who are you? I am who I am. That's who my name is, and that's who you can tell him. Well, what if they don't believe me? Well, here, Moses, take your stick, throw it on the ground. It turns into a snake, and then God says, here, you pick that snake up by the tail. Would you pick up a snake by the tail? He does, and it turns back into a stick. And God shows him a bunch of other cool magic tricks that Moses can do to impress Pharaoh. Moses says, but I'm a lousy public speaker. God says, listen, who made your mouth? Finally, Moses just says, look, Lord, please, can you just send somebody else? And God says, no, but I will send your brother Aaron with you. In fact, he's on his way now. So Moses, finally convinced, gets permission from his father-in-law to leave. He puts his wife and kid, or kids, depending on how you read the text. We don't know exactly how many kids he had at this point. Puts them all on donkeys and starts heading to Egypt. And that's where we get to this part of the text. Now, I would like to make two observations and as we jump back into the text, and that is this. So first of all, I think that God disciplines all of us on some level. If we are truly trying to live into the fullness that God has in store for us, we need some discipline. We need God to come and knock us back on course. And the second piece is that when this discipline comes, it often comes in a way that cuts right to the heart of the issue and is very specific to what each of us is struggling with. Sometimes to the point that when we try and explain it to others, they can't quite grasp the depth and the profundity of what's going on because it is so specific to us and to what God is doing inside of us. And I believe that is no exception for Moses here. So, picking it up at verse 21, Exodus 4:21, the Lord said to Moses, "When you go back to Egypt, see that you perform." See that you perform before Pharaoh all the wonders that I have put in your power, and I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. And then you shall say to Pharaoh, "Thus says the Lord, Israel is my firstborn son. I said to you, let my son go that he may worship me, but you refused to let him go. Now I will kill your firstborn son." On the way, at a place where they spent the night, the Lord met him and tried to kill him. But Zipporah took a flint knife, cut off her son's foreskin, and touched his feet with it, and said, "Truly you are a bridegroom of blood to me." So he let him alone. It was then that she said, "A bridegroom of blood by circumcision." Now this account of God attacking Moses raises so many questions, especially when one looks at the Hebrew language behind it. You may have noticed that if you've got your Bible, yes, thank you. You may notice that right here, it just says, the Lord met him. Who? Moses? Moses' kid? Who is it talking about? And sought to put him to death. Then Zipporah took a flint knife, cut off her son's foreskin and skin, and touched Moses's. You'll notice there's actually, this is another, touched his feet with it. Whose? And said, "Surely you are a bridegroom of blood to me." So he let him alone, presumably God. It was then that she said, "A bridegroom of blood because of the circumcision." And if you're like me, I go, because that last sentence is kind of an explanation, I go, that doesn't explain anything. So what on earth does all this mean? Some of the questions that come to my mind is, who is God attacking? Is it Moses? Is it the child? Why is God trying to kill Moses if God just spent so much time and effort trying to get Moses to go on this journey to begin with? What exactly was the nature of the attack? Some commentators say, well, this is just Hebrew language for Moses got really, really sick. Other people say, no. There was something much bigger and more dramatic that was going on. How does Zipporah know what to do? Something's going on. She can figure that out. She immediately deduces what needs to happen is I gotta circumcise my kid. Clearly, we're missing some other pieces to the puzzle. Why does the son's circumcision save Moses? And what on earth does a bridegroom of blood mean? All right. For the most part, I can't answer these questions. Neither can most commentaries. Many huge amounts of scholarship have been written on these verses. But because the source material is so vague and so ancient, even ancient Jewish commentators don't know exactly how to handle this text. But I think it is safe to say that we can make the following conclusions. So first, that God did attack somebody. Fair enough? Somebody got attacked. And God seems to be in it. It seems most logical that it's Moses, seeing that if it wasn't Moses, you would assume that Moses would probably be the one circumcising the kid, not Zipporah. And the kid, the child isn't mentioned anywhere earlier, so you'd think that the he would correspond. But so we're going to run with the idea that it's Moses. And the second thing is that whatever this was behind this attack, and whatever it's going on, circumcision clearly has a role to play in it. Again, fair enough? Okay. Now, if you recall, I said earlier that these moments of divine discipline come at pivotal moments in a person's faith journey. Or perhaps more accurately, they create pivotal moments in a person's faith journey. And here, Moses is on his way to begin his work among the Egyptians and the Israelites who are in Egypt. And just before entering into his mission, before crossing the border into Egypt, he is confronted. I also suggested that the nature of these confrontations is often of a deeply personal nature and cuts right to the point of whatever issue yet stands between the individual and God. The vague, archaic language here may be the result of information being lost over the millennia as the story is passed down. Or it could be that the kind of vagueness that surrounds the talk of soldiers who have seen combat and are asked to talk about it is the same kind of vagueness that we're getting here. I don't know if you've ever encountered this, but my grandfather came in D-Day on the shores of Normandy. And one of the things he used to tell my dad was that when you hear soldiers talking about how exciting combat is, how glorious, that's usually a surefire sign that they haven't seen much of it. The soldiers who have seen combat are not very excited to talk about it. Usually because their experience is so horrifying and so personal, so deeply rooted, it's not something they want to get into. If they talk about it at all, they will use very vague strokes to paint a very basic picture. But when you start asking them personal questions, it goes, the doors start to close. So, though precisely what was going on is a mystery to us in this text, it was clearly not a mystery to Moses or Zipporah. They understood. Both seemed to understand what was happening, and therefore Zipporah, his wife, springs into action. And personal though it was not beyond the comprehension of Moses' spouse, which I find to be very encouraging, that a spouse can actually help you out. So what was this whole thing about? I offer the following conjectures. First of all, Moses had been commissioned by God, and he was acting in obedience to that call. But for some reason, his son had not been circumcised. Circumcision was the sign of the covenant given by God to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob to confirm those who were a part of the people of God. To be uncircumcised was to be standing intentionally outside of God's promises and apart from the people of God. Now, we can only guess as to why Moses' son had not been circumcised. Perhaps he had never broached the subject with his in-laws. Remember, his father-in-law was a pagan priest, so maybe this was kind of a taboo subject. Perhaps the couple was worried about the child's health, because, you know, if you're doing this with a flint knife, there's a lot of possibility of infection. Or perhaps Moses felt that his own cultural identity was such a mess, he didn't want to impose anything on his child. But whatever the case, what it conveyed, the circumcision or not circumcision, was so significant that Moses nearly lost his life over it. Here are some issues that I think are at play. First of all, just as God told Moses that because Pharaoh would not release God's firstborn son, Israel, he would strike Moses' firstborn son, Moses must decide to whom his household belongs. Is Moses going to choose to identify himself as God's son or Moses' son? And how will he choose to identify his family? He cannot be the mouthpiece of God if he is not willing to identify himself and his family with God's people. There's also a piece, I think, of divine authority. Moses had obeyed God, but only after a great deal of hesitation and haggling. Moses learns very, very strongly in this moment that God is not to be trifled with. And his commands are very real and are intended to be obeyed. And these are just a few of the things that I think we can glean out of this story. At a mission-critical moment, God chose to confront Moses over his own identity and the identity of his family. Would Moses identify himself and his people with God? Would Moses acknowledge that his firstborn son belonged to God along with everything else? Would Moses choose to be obedient in all aspects of his life? And Moses is not the only example of this kind of divine discipline. Let me offer a few more examples. You've got Abraham following God around the Middle East in pursuit of a promise. Do you remember part of that promise? It was for offspring. Your offspring will be more numerous than the sands on the seashore. And does that offspring come quickly? No. Waits and waits and waits and waits. And Abraham, at numerous times, starts to take things into his own hands. They come to Egypt for Egypt. It keeps coming up. They get to Egypt, and his wife Sarah is very attractive. And Abraham says, well, if the Pharaoh sees you, he's going to want to marry you, and he'll probably try to kill me, so we'll just pretend we're brother and sister, and we can let Pharaoh marry you if we have to. Well, that's exactly what happens. Pharaoh marries Abraham's wife, and then a plague breaks out among Pharaoh's court, and Pharaoh says, why didn't you tell me she was your wife? I would have left her alone. But think for a moment what this means for the promise, okay? Abraham had been promised that he would have descendants. It's not working between him and his wife. Here's a chance to pass his wife off to a king. Maybe that's the way that God is going to bring about descendants. Oh, clearly not. God says, Abraham, what are you doing? Don't do that. This happens again with another king, but this time the king that almost takes Sarah for a wife catches it beforehand and says, why do you do this to me? Abraham thinks, well, maybe this isn't the way. And Sarah says, well, why don't you take my serving girl and take her as a wife and have a baby through her? And he does. And that kid's named Ishmael. But God says, no, Abraham, you're cheating. You got to wait. Finally, a child is born. When they're in their, what, hundreds? I mean, they are really stinking old. A child is born. And they name him Isaac, which means laughter. And so they're laughing, ha, 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 ha. And then, What is the divine confrontation? What does God ask Abraham to do with this son that has finally arrived? Go and sacrifice him. Take him up on the mountain and offer him as a sacrifice. God knew what the specific thing was that Abraham was still holding on to. Abraham, you've trusted me with everything else. Are you willing to trust me with this? Will you do it? Another example. This one, I think, more closely mirrors the vagueness and obscurity of our passage. The story of Jacob. Okay, so Abraham's grandson. Jacob was one of a set of twins. His brother Esau. Esau means red. You can call him Big Red. He's a big, red, hairy man's man. Goes out into the wilderness, hunts things. Jacob, you kind of get the sense that he was a little more of a wormy kind of kid. He kind of hung around. He always stayed with the tents. Esau would go out hunting. All right. It was said that the younger son, Jacob, was going to inherit the family blessing and the family wealth. This was not the way it was supposed to be, right? The oldest son gets everything. Well, Jacob manages to trick his older brother out of both the family inheritance and the family's blessing. Winds up having to run for his life. He gets there, and he winds up actually getting tricked by his uncle, who makes him work for 14 years to win the hand of one of his daughters, and then he quickly does a switcheroo and says, oh, I forgot to tell you, I have to marry the oldest sister first. You can work for me for another 7 years. So finally, Joseph escapes from his uncle with his two wives and children in tow, and now he's got a whole bunch of flocks and herds that God has blessed him with. And where does he decide to go? He's been told by God, now is the time for you to go back home. Home, says Jacob, that's where my brother lives. Much as Moses said, back to Egypt, that's where I'm a wanted man. Jacob goes down, and as he's getting closer and closer to arriving in the territory, he starts to divide up his flocks and herds because he's going, all right, if Esau comes at me, I got to minimize my losses. And he starts carving up, and he says, okay, these 200 sheep, I'm going to send them ahead of me as a gift, because he's gotten reports that Esau is on his way to meet him as an advance guard, and he's got 400 armed men with him. It's bad news. So he says, okay, these sheep are going to go ahead of me. And when you get asked, what's with these sheep? You say, it's a gift from Jacob. Jacob's a little behind, but these are yours. So sheep, camels, goats, donkeys, everything he's sending across. Finally, it's just down to him and his family. And he's camped at the edge of this river called the Jabbok River. And so he sends over the rest of his belongings. And then at night, he's like, okay, I've got to do it. And he sends across his family. But he himself is the last one to cross. And the Bible has this really weird statement. It says, he sent over his family so that Jacob was left alone on that side. And then, with no other explanation, and a man came and wrestled him until daybreak. Where did this person come from? Why are they wrestling? What is going on? But you catch that same vague, weird, mysterious element of this, where all of a sudden this is happening in the dark by the side of this river. Jacob has just sent everything he owns across. It's just him and this guy. Did I tell you that the name Jacob means heel grabber? When he and his twin brother were in the womb, their mom said, oh my gosh, what are these kids doing? Because they were fighting in the womb. And fighting to see who was going to come out first. Esau was born first. Firstborn! But as he's coming out of the birth canal, they pull the first baby out, and grabbing onto the heel of the firstborn is Jacob. Come back here! And you get this sense all through Jacob's life. He's always having to fight and grab and scrape for every little scrap of something he can get. He's not the firstborn, so he has to fight and steal and take. And now, God confronts him alone. You want to be the wrestler? You want to be the fighter, Jacob? Now's the time to deal with it. Let's go. Here's the mat. And all of a sudden, they fight until daybreak. And the Bible says that as they struggled, the man, unnamed, when he realized that he couldn't quite overtake Jacob, he cheats, reaches over, touches Jacob's hip, and magically it dislocates. Ouch! But Jacob still doesn't let go. He says, I will not let you go until you give me a blessing. And so then the man says, well, what's your name? Jacob! Really? Not anymore. Now it's Israel. Israel means the one who struggles with God. And he says, I will bless you. So he blesses him. And then Jacob says, well, who are you? What's your name? And the guy says, why do you need to know my name? Bye-bye. Poof. And so after this intense struggle, it's morning now. What does Jacob have to do? Go catch up with his family and go meet with his brother. And after this intense struggle, instead of walking across the river like, hey, brother, hope you don't kill me, he comes across the river because his hip is dislocated. Now he is this broken man limping across the river. And when he sees Esau, he bows seven times. And you get this actually really beautiful moment of reconciliation. Esau runs to him and just embraces him, gives him a big hug. Now they still don't trust each other. It's not over and done. But there is this sense that God took that moment to speak to Jacob in a deeply personal way that resonated with him. Another quick example about the rich young ruler from the Gospels. Remember this story? A young man comes to Jesus, says, hey, Jesus, what do I have to do to inherit eternal life? Jesus says, well, you know the commandments, you know, love the Lord your God, don't steal, don't commit adultery. He says, I've been to youth group. I've been doing all those since I was a kid, but I'm still missing something. What am I missing? And Jesus says, all right, you really want to do this? Yes. Sell everything you have and give it to the poor. And then come follow me. Do Jesus knew how to cut right to the issue. If you really want this, says Jesus, you got to give it up. Let it go. This thing, this is my call for you. Let it go. Follow me. Or how about the story of Mary? This often gets overlooked. So Mary, the like Mary and Martha, Mary. So two sisters and a brother, Mary, Martha, Lazarus. They all live in a happy little house in Bethany. Things are going great. They're all disciples of Jesus, right? Until Lazarus gets really sick. Mary and Martha send messages to Jesus, who's in another town over. Lord, the disciple you love, he's sick. Come get him. Does he come? No. Does Lazarus die? Yes. Lazarus dies. Jesus knows about it, and he comes. But you see two very different responses from the sisters. So there's a whole bunch of people from the community. They're all at the house. They're mourning, right? Martha meets Jesus on the road. She comes to him and says, Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not be dead. But then she quickly follows it up and says, but I know that even now God will do whatever you ask. And Jesus says, hey, you hang in there, hang in there. Now Mary, on the other hand, didn't even bother to meet Jesus at the road. But Jesus, from the road, says to Martha, hey, where's Mary? I know she's stricken with grief. Where is she? I want to see her. And so when news comes back to Mary that Jesus is actually asking for her, she gets up and she comes down the road. And you can get the sense of the angst, the anger, the grief coming at her. When she gets to Jesus, she just collapses in a heap, saying the exact words that Martha did. Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died. But there, with her, there's none of this. But even now, I know that you can. No, it's just, I'm really angry. You could have done something, and now it's too late. And it's at that moment, as Jesus looks at Mary and looks at the people with her, that you have the shortest verse in the Bible. Jesus wept. He was deeply moved. And then what does he do? He goes to Lazarus' tomb, says, roll back the stone, Lazarus, come forth, and he raises Lazarus from the dead. Powerful stuff. Pivotal moment in Mary's faith. A few weeks later, Jesus comes back to Mary, Martha, and Lazarus' house. There's a big dinner, but there in the text, you can also see that there's this big discussion among the disciples. Do we really want to go back there, Jesus? Because at this point in the story, it's heading up to Holy Week now. If they cross over to Bethany, they are officially in Judea. They're out of Galilee into Judea, and the powers that be have jurisdiction to capture Jesus and accuse him. They know, essentially, that if Jesus chooses to go to Lazarus and Mary's house, he's signing his own death warrant. Like there's very little chance that he's going to be able to get out of this alive. Jesus says, no, the time has come. Let's go. And so on their way to the whole triumphal entry thing, they stop first at Mary's house. And there's Lazarus, who's back from the dead, and he's kind of a celebrity, and the Pharisees are trying to figure out how to kill him too. And as they're having dinner, do you remember what Mary does? She's the one who goes and gets that bottle of expensive perfume, comes in, breaks it over Jesus, and washes his feet with her hair. And the disciples are really put out by this. They say, what? What is going on? I mean, first of all, it's, you know, it's overload on the perfume. It was really expensive perfume to the tune of, say, like a $40,000 or $50,000 bottle. And then to have a woman expose her hair in that culture was very, very immodest. There was a famous woman back in the, you know, first century, who she had had a couple of her sons become high priests, and when people asked her, how is it that you are so blessed? Her response was, the very rafters of my home have never seen my hair. And she, I'm super modest, nothing, I completely concealed. And here's Mary actually washing Jesus' feet with her hair. This is extremely intimate. What's that about? Well, Jesus tells his disciples, you know, she's preparing me for my burial. But what's interesting is that this is in the Gospel of John. The Gospel of John does not have an account of the Lord's Supper. It does have the account of Jesus washing the disciples' feet. Mary got it. She understood what the appropriate response was. She washed Jesus' feet in a way that was fitting. The disciples, when it came to that Last Supper, completely missed it. They were busy arguing about who should wash each other's feet. God spoke to Mary in a profoundly personal way, and it elicited a profoundly personal response. All right, you have time for one more? One last one. How about Peter? Okay. So you have Peter being the disciple who he becomes a disciple when Jesus borrows his boat. He needs a speaking platform to get him away from the crowd a little bit so they're not trampling him and he can still preach. Jesus says to Peter, hey, take your boat out a little bit. Have you caught anything? No. Well, why don't you try now? All right. What am I supposed to do? Throw the net out, yada, yada. Whoa, fish! And Peter falls to his knees and says, Lord, Lord, you know, I'm not worthy to have you on my boat. And Jesus says, hey, come be fishers of men. Come join my posse. Great. Fast forward, Peter's always brash and trying to do all sorts of things, including in the Passion Week, Lord, I will never deny you. Jesus says, you'll deny me three times. That is exactly what happens. And then Easter comes. Jesus pops back up. He says, peace be with you. He says to Thomas, you know, you wanted to see that it's really me. Here, look at the holes in my hands, the holes in my side. But he doesn't square things with Peter, at least not in that upper room setting. What he does say is, all right, I want you disciples, we're moving this thing out. I want you to meet me in Galilee where we met up first. You go ahead. I'm going to go ahead. You meet me out there. Now, the Bible doesn't give any concrete directions as to exactly what the disciples are supposed to do while they're waiting or where exactly Jesus is supposed to meet them at. So they get there, and Peter kind of sitting around says, you know what? What the heck? Let's go fishing. I'm tired of waiting. Let's go fishing. Anybody else in? So, oh, okay, we'll go fish. So they get in. Bible says they're out all night. Do they catch anything? No. Very discouraging for a professional fisherman. As the dawn is coming up and they're pulling up their empty nets, there's somebody on the shore who has the brilliant advice, hey, friends, have you caught anything? No. Try throwing your nets on the other side of the boat. Thanks, pal. But, of course, they do, and then they've got so many fish that the boats are in danger of sinking. Somebody shouts, it's the Lord! And Peter says, oh, it is! And he's standing there in his underpants, but he grabs his clothes, jumps in the water, swims to shore, and there's Jesus. And he's already got some fish cooking on some coals, and they eat breakfast together, and everybody's too chicken to ask, is it really you? They know it's Jesus. After that, though, this is what Jesus says. When they had finished breakfast, Jesus said to Simon Peter, Simon, son of John, do you love me more than these? And he said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Jesus said to him, feed my lambs. A second time, Jesus said to him, Simon, son of John, do you love me? He said to him, yes, Lord, you know that I love you. Jesus said to him, tend my sheep. He said to him the third time, Simon, son of John, do you love me? And Peter felt hurt because he said to him the third time, do you love me? And he said to him, Lord, you know everything. You know that I love you. Jesus said to him, feed my sheep. Very truly I tell you, when you were younger, you used to fasten your own belt and to go wherever you wished. But when you grow old, you will stretch out your hands and somebody else will fasten a belt around you and take you where you do not wish to go. And then the Bible adds this parentheses. It says, he said this to indicate the kind of death by which Peter would glorify God. And after this, Jesus said to him, follow me. What is that about? One of the key issues, I think, for Peter as he was wrestling with how he could get back on track with God was this question of, does he really love Jesus? Now, Jesus knew that Peter did. He also knew that Peter was fallible, but they needed to clear the air a little bit. And there was this interchange, do you love me? One spoken for each time that Peter had denied Christ. Do you love me? Yeah. Do you love me? Yeah. Do you really love me? Yeah. What's this little bit at the end? Very truly I tell you, when you were younger, you used to fasten your own belt and go wherever you wished. But when you grow old, you will stretch out your hands and someone else will fasten a belt around you and take you where you do not wish to go. I think in a way what Jesus was saying was, I believe you, Peter. And I'm going to tell you right now that you're going to make it. You're actually going to be faithful to the very end. You are going to be taken somewhere when you're older to a place where you don't want to go. but you're going to stay true. It's going to be rough, but you're going to hold fast the whole time. So you see this pattern of God being able to speak very specifically, very personally, to every single person that he is interacting with. So, as we wrap things up, I would invite you, take a moment to reflect on your life right now. Have there been times that God has confronted you or intersected you in a way that is cutting deep to some of the issues that are inside of you? Are there things that are yet unresolved that need to be resolved? Have you ever prayed and invited God's discipline? He will give it. Reflecting on Moses' experience here, where there was already a command given that he had not been faithful to, let me throw this out to you. If you are a Christian, have you been baptized? If you have not, is there a reason why? It's something that Christ has commanded all of his followers. Or perhaps another thing would be, do you have something that you need to confess, to get off your chest? Don't let that stand between you and Christ. Or another thing too, have you been faithful in the things that you've turned over to God, including your finances? Moses needed to be encouraged to surrender his own firstborn son. Many of you don't have children. Are you giving what you can? As a little side note, I served briefly as the church secretary at our church, and the pastors were not privy to giving information, but as the church secretary, I was, because I had to process all the money. I was very surprised to see who was giving and who wasn't. There were some people who I thought, really? That's all you're giving? And others that I was like, really? You're giving that much? I would encourage you, if tithing, giving 10%, is not a part of your regular rhythm of faith, make it so. How can you really say you trust God if you don't trust him with your money? In conclusion, though, let me wrap up with these words from the letter to the Hebrews. This is from chapter 12, right after he talks about the great cloud of witnesses that surround us running the race. The author says this: consider him, Christ, who endured such hostility against himself from sinners, so that you may not grow weary or lose heart. In your struggle against sin, you have not yet resisted to the point of shedding your own blood. And you have completely forgotten the exhortation that addresses you as children. Quote, my children, do not regard lightly the Lord's discipline or lose heart when you are punished by him. For the Lord disciplines those whom he loves, and he chastises every child whom he accepts. Endure trials for the sake of discipline. God is treating you as children. For what child is there whom a parent does not discipline? If you do not have that discipline in which all children share, then you are illegitimate and not his children. Moreover, we had human parents to discipline us, and we respected them. Should we not be even more willing to be subject to the Father of spirits and live? For they disciplined us for a short time as seemed best to them, but he disciplines us for our good, in order that we may share his holiness. Now, discipline always seems painful rather than pleasant at the time, but later it yields the peaceful fruit of righteousness to those who have been trained by it. Therefore, lift up your drooping hands and strengthen your weak knees and make straight paths for your feet, so that what is lame may not be put out of joint, but rather healed.